Letters to Lelia, by Francis Rosenfeld. Chapter 2, The Gates of Perception. Who is in charge of the hors d'oeuvres? Seth asked. Sister Abigail, Roberta replied, focused on a delicate piece of machinery that needed soldering under the microscope. You're not serious, Seth yelled, making Roberta's hand shake for a second. The pen slid over the board, covering it with a slobber of molten metal. Thanks, Roberta snapped, snatched the slide from the microscope, and threw it on the growing pile of similar slides in the trash can, proof that the sister had kept very busy the whole morning. Who in their right mind would put Sister Abigail in charge of cooking anything? Seth continued, like a slow-growing storm, ready to strike at any moment. Do you realize that I've been working on that board for the last 6 hours and I finally got it right? Sister Roberta growled at Seth. That means your next one will be even better. Who put Sister Abigail in charge of the hors d'oeuvres? Seth asked, deadly calm. What do I care? Why don't you ask Lily? She's managing the festivities, Roberta replied, eager to see Seth go away. If the frustration of having to sit through a whole day of wisp rhetoric doesn't get us, the food is sure to, the leader said, leaving. She went straight to Sarah's apothecary, where the latter was trying to escape a growing group that was trailing her with a list of demands and modifications wherever she went. I see you found me. Sarah expressed her displeasure. I thought I was better company than that. Seth protested, offended. You were. Now every time someone approaches, they have a request. What is yours? The redhead pointed out. Who put Sister Abigail in charge of cooking? Does anybody other than me think that this choice was made specifically to spoil the event? Sarah was familiar with Sister Abigail's cooking and waved her head sadly. Abigail had no task when the list was sent to Vlor for approval, so she was assigned by default to the only job left, Sarah explained. Why don't we ask her to do something else and let Sister Jessie take care of the food? Seth asked. It's too late. The assignments have already been approved. It would take another month to get this through the channels, and we only have 23 days to the event, the redhead explained naturally. And all of this makes perfect sense to you, it seems? Seth continued her chain of logic, as if talking to an incapacitated person. Has everyone here lost every drop of common sense? It is procedure, Sarah continued, obfuscating the leader even more. We are not eating Sister Abigail's cooking. Even if we were willing, it wouldn't be advisable. Remember last time? Seth spoke mellifluously. She was referring to a particular bean soup recipe that had engendered gruesome side effects for a whole week on their entire group. Due to the resilience imparted by the purple genes, all the sisters made a full recovery, but Sister Abigail was forbidden to touch a frying pan going forward. Many of the sisters swore off beans altogether after that event, and considering their very long lives, that spelled serious commitment. Sarah nodded again, in agreement. Who is going to not give us food poisoning during the blessed event? Seth asked, come. Sister Jessie can coordinate the kitchen staff, but we have to have Sister Abigail's name on the official record. As I said, not enough time to get another approval. She's going to have to be in the kitchen at the time, too. Sarah continued. Seth looked her in the eyes with an icy stare. Do you understand that I never put up with this nonsense? She asked the redhead, who did understand. Lily is really squeezed. The wisps are pretty adamant about adhering to a set course of action. Please don't make us go through another 7-layer cake of approvals. Sarah begged, staring at the leader, almost in tears, in the hope that this new bureaucratic nightmare could miraculously be avoided. I must have lost the gift of eloquence. I thought I made myself clear, Seth continued, deadly calm, but throwing thunderbolts with her eyes. Sarah's hope sank in a puddle of wretchedness and she threw herself on the window seat, dejected. She decided to approach the issue from another angle. What if we skip the appetizers altogether? It's not like anybody is going to be hungry. Anyway, besides, with the dragons there, it's going to be difficult to keep the food uncovered. We can serve beverages, some light refreshments. Sarah attempted a diversion. Seth stared at her blankly. No, the wisps don't even need food. They're going to be floating around blended together like a vat of cotton candy, Sarah protested. Not everything is about the wisps, the leader replied. Take care of it. Why me? Sarah asked. Why don't you ask Lily? I have enough on my plate as it is. Handle it, the leader said and left. Sarah was reluctant to walk back to Lily's office, especially after the previous day's outburst, and dragged her feet all the way there, trying not to feel any unpleasantness over the situation. It's not like this was a life and death situation. She couldn't understand why Seth was so adamant about having her way, Besides, she was sure everyone would be way too nervous to eat. She had to give it to the wisps. Their fusion clouds were the vision of a lifetime, and the fact that one of their own was going to participate in one seemed surreal. Sarah couldn't help wonder how creatures so advanced chose to maintain their society in such an administrative nightmare. She mumbled to herself all the way to the solenoid room about the second circle's rules, Abigail's inability to cook and her own penchant to avoid confrontation at all costs. Who cared? It was just food after all. She realized she was going to have to stop by Abigail's place and let her know she wasn't going to do any cooking, and she felt awkward about the whole situation, even though Abigail was probably not going to care one way or another. She groaned at the thought of having to sit through another two-hour session with the mobile assembly and justify the reasons for the personnel change. Landing Bay, Terra 2, July 4, 3245. My darling, I never told this story to anyone until now. It is one of those life-changing events that divide your days into between and after, and the person I became as a result didn't feel comfortable discussing it. I decided to share it with you, to maybe help you realize that not everything in this life is meant to be understood. I was a bit of a daredevil in my youth, living defiantly and always looking for the next challenge. As luck has it, I got word that a spot had become available on a safari expedition to the Serengeti, and the news made me bounce off the walls with excitement. This was exactly the kind of activity I used to plan my life around. I left in a hurry, with only one small backpack and a change of clothes, and the trip unfolded uneventfully from the moment I landed in Dar es Salaam until we embarked on the all-terrain vehicles. A few days into the expedition, hot and sweaty under the African sun, we saw a watering hole in the distance, a wonderful opportunity to take pictures of wildlife and refill our canteens with water. As quiet as we tried to be, we still startled a small group of zebras and gazelles, to the displeasure of the lion pride who watched placidly as their afternoon snack ran away. They were enjoying their afternoon siesta a short distance from us, in the tall grass of the savanna and under the rare foliage of an acacia tree. We wandered about, careful not to disturb them, filled our containers with water and were getting ready to leave. The group was tired and absent-minded from all that relentless sun bearing down on us, and, as I said, some things defy understanding, so this is what happened next. As I straddled the rocky shore, trying to approach the water, I slipped and fell, and in the process cut a deep gash in my leg. The pain was so intense I passed out instantly. I didn't have time to scream for help, or see the tired and distracted group get back into the vehicles and leave. I don't know how long it was until I came to, but it was night already, and I could hear the terrifying roars of the lions getting ready for the morning hunt. I was sure that the smell of blood would draw them to me, and it was just a matter of time until I ended up as their next meal. I couldn't move and felt that a fever was starting to build up, clouding my vision and my thinking. I must have lost a lot of blood, because I was going in and out of consciousness, and the last image I saw before I passed out again was the gigantic shape of a growling lioness sniffing my face, hesitantly. A strange sensation woke me up at noon, and upon awaking I noticed that I was laying comfortably on a bed of flattened grasses, in the middle of a group of resting lions, and the large lioness from the night before was licking my wound. I wasn't well and felt the fever rising, and then passed out again. I knew I was going to die. It wasn't possible for me to survive without medical attention, food or water, and the fever drove me into mottled dreamscapes, in a halfway place between life and death, where I could see both but experience neither. I had vivid visions there, extraordinarily beautiful visions of creatures whose countenance I couldn't even describe, whose features were melting in the intense blue light of their being, multifaceted and fading in and out of reality and living in dimensions not available to the human senses. I felt their infinite love, their concern for me, and in my feverish dream state watched them debate my fate. They stopped every now and then to see how I was faring and I got scared, because I thought I already died and it was my judgment day, and maybe it was, I will never know, will I? But I was also mesmerized. I couldn't take my eyes off of their surreal beauty, whose simple existence engendered bliss. Every now and then I woke up, startled by the rough tongue of the lioness licking my wound, or her grabbing me by the back of my shirt and carrying me to the water and back, growling softly to encourage me to drink. For days I went back and forth between that extraordinary world filled with beings of light and the weirdly cozy nest of my adoptive lion pride, and in my feverish mind they seemed one and the same somehow, and because of that I felt safe. The roars of the lions didn't scare me anymore. I heard their growls and saw their graceful movements in the moonlight, and knew that I was protected among them. The fact that I got better was in itself a miracle. I don't know how that happened and can't explain it, other than divine providence, and as my strength returned, the world beyond life slowly faded. I was so sad, so extraordinary hurt to let it go, it felt like I was ripped apart from half of myself. Every time I lifted my eyes, I saw the lioness care for me with the love and dedication she would only give her own cubs, while the other members of the pride glanced tolerantly in my direction, willing to share the fruits of their common hunt with the strange sickly pup that I was. My adoptive lioness chewed up little morsels of raw meat and thrust them in my direction, licking my face and nudging me with its nose to eat. I wished I could, but my stomach revolted when a tiny morsel of the offering reached it. However, as my health returned, it brought with it a ravenous hunger, and I quenched it with the acacia flowers that were blooming abundantly at the time. I didn't understand why the lion pride decided to accept me as a member, instead of seeing me as the yummy lunch that I was, but I didn't feel in danger in any way among them and started appreciating how unusual and extraordinary this experience was, living among the lions, something that the overheated imagination and thirst for adventure of my reckless youth could not conjure under normal circumstances. My sweet child, you know what Sister Joseph keeps saying, you don't need to look for trouble, trouble is sure to find you. There is no way, in your daily life, to anticipate or prepare for a situation like the one above, it is something you just live through, grow from, and are forever changed. Nobody can stay the same after visiting thereafter, and I was no exception. Every priority I had, every ambition, every drive, faded in the magnitude of existence itself and the awe of things that defy understanding. It almost felt normal living among the lions, so I had no inclination to leave, but I was a grown-up cub, and it was time for me to explore my own trails. The pride moved on as I set out towards a thicket of trees in the distance. I don't know why I picked that direction, but I was sure in my heart it was the right one, and that proved to be the case. Before parting, my adoptive lioness jumped and placed its front paws on my shoulders, almost crushing me under her massive weight. As I looked at its majestic bearing, almost 7 foot tall as it was standing in front of me, I realized how lucky I was. It could have squelched me with a pat of its paws, or killed me with one bite if it ever wanted to. The lioness looked at me with what in a human's eyes I would have read as great sadness, then jumped back with a small growl, turned its back at me, rejoined the pride and never looked back. There I was, walking completely alone and exposed through the tall grass of the savanna while small herds of wildebeest, gazelles and giraffes passed me by, oblivious. I cried the entire time, out of weakness, out of relief to be alive, out of hard to define emotions. I cried because I missed my newfound lion family, as absurd as it sounds, I cried at the loss of that extraordinary world beyond life, so unbelievable in its infinite dimensions that even the stunning beauty of the Serengeti Plains, punctured by rock outcroppings and caressed by sinuous slow-flowing rivers, seemed dull by comparison. I was still crying when I reached the small clump of trees, and crying when the rare trees turned into a jungle, whose vague, unmarked trails led me to a small Maasai village. The villagers took care of me and dressed my wound with a thick mixture of herbs and bark to help it heal completely. When I was healthy enough to travel, they took me with them to Zanzibar on one of their trips to the spice market. The rest of the story is quite mundane, filled with modern conveniences and administrative requirements. I re-established my identity, got travel papers, figured out how to contact my family and got a plane ticket back to Singapore. I performed all of these tasks in a daze, as if watching somebody else's life, and when I got back home my mind was so far away that my family almost didn't recognize me. Upon returning I tried to pick up where I left off, but it all felt fake, like wearing someone else's life, someone whose personality you neither click with, nor admire. As I said, some moments divide life into before and after, and the people who inhabit these separate parts are very different. I wasn't afraid of death before this adventure, obviously, otherwise I wouldn't have defied it on a dare at every turn, but after I realized that not being afraid of death and not caring about life are two completely different things. I could not shake the vivid visions from that feverish state between life and death. I couldn't believe that experience was for nothing, just a random meaningless occurrence. I wanted my life to count for something, even if what I saw might have been just a wild firing of neurons and massive release of endorphins at the approach of death. I didn't know where to start in my search for meaning, so I joined this small community gardening group, which had some religious affiliations, and since my daredevil was just tamed, not dead, I jumped at the chance to join some of them on a trip to a small experimental farm in the south of France, which had the reputation of working miracles in the world of horticulture. I was supposed to be there only for a week, but again, faithful to my drive to live on impulse, I stayed. The sisters didn't ask why, or for how long, They just prepared a bed for me and gave me a tiny lot of brick rubble to work on. How strange is life, huh? You know, it's a good thing to plan your future, but if you plan it too tightly, you won't leave any room for really extraordinary events. Whether that is a good thing or a bad thing, it is for you to decide. Be blessed, my dear, and may God grant you the fulfillment of your life's purpose. Devotedly yours, Sister Abigail.